his work. Some of you may be aware of an essay that John Bell wrote in the 70s called How to Teach Special Relativity. It's somewhat notorious, insofar as it's known, because it really harks back to intuitions, dynamical intuitions, that are found in the work of Einstein's predecessors, that's to say the ether theorists, about how to understand things like so-called kinematical effects like length contraction and time dilation. When I first read this paper, I was convinced that it was completely wrong-headed, but slowly came around to thinking that there was something rather profound about this paper. And I was wondering, along with Oliver Cooley, who collaborated with me on papers on the foundations of relativity theory, did it really make sense in the context of general relativity? The paper, of course, was designed to give you an understanding, a dynamical understanding of length contraction and time dilation. In other words, it was designed to try to cut down the distinction between dynamics and kinematics. And the question that arose was, does this really work in the context of general relativity? In other words, does Bell's argument go through? If you think of special relativity as the appropriate limiting case of general relativity. In the process, I started to get interested in what do we mean by geometry in physics, and in particular in general relativity. So this is sort of tied up with this issue. I have to say from the outset, I don't have a theory of a philosophy of geometry. But I feel a little bit like Samuel Johnson when he was asked what light was. He said, nobody knows what light is. All that we can say is we know what it isn't. So that's the sort of the philosophy of this paper. I don't know what geometry is, but I have a feeling I know what it is. So I'm going to start with general relativity rather than special relativity, and then I'm going to work back to special relativity and then hopefully close the circle. Here's a section from James Anderson's very, very impressive book on general relativity, 1967. From the point of view of the principle of general invariance, or what we would now say general covariance, we need not interpret g mu nu as a metric, nor r mu nu as a Ricci tensor. Einstein's field equations do not rest on such an interpretation. One can show that they're the only dynamical equations of second differential order for a symmetric tensor that are in accord with the principle of general invariance as we've interpreted. We don't have to worry about the details as to how he got Einstein's field equations from the principle of general covariance. But he's raising an interesting issue here. If you just take the field equations per se, what does g mu nu mean, I mean, apart from the second rank dynamical tensor field? And in particular, what is its connection with Rosenthal? As in all physical theories, we will look for the consequences of the field equations that lead us to associate there should be g mu nu there with some observable element of the physical world. Actually, the field equations aren't going to do it. Field equations won't be enough. We'll see later. In a similar vein, although a slightly different argument, there's a relatively famous passage from Carlo Rovelli, where he talks about a strong burst of gravitational waves coming from the sky and knocking down the rock of Gibraltar. This is something of an exaggeration, because anybody knows anything about the tests for gravitational waves, I mean, made at the moment. It's a slight exaggeration, but anyway. Precisely as a strong burst of electromagnetic radiation could. Why is the second, that's to say electromagnetic radiation, so-called matter, in the first space? We think of g mu nu as being a property of space-time. Why should we regard the first burst as ontologically different from the second? Clearly, the distinction can now be seen as ill-founded. I'm not sure about clearly, but there is a point here. Physical reality is now described as a complex interacting ensemble of entities, fields, the location of which is only meaningful with respect to one another. The relation amongst dynamical entities being contiguous is the foundation of space-time structure. This really has more to do with Einstein's whole argument and the meaning of general covariance, the undetermination of field equations, and so on. But he says amongst these various entities, there is one, the gravitational field, which interacts with every other one and thus determines the relative motion of the individual components of every object we want to use as a rod and clock. Because of that, it admits of a metrical interpretation. Now, this, what Rovelli is saying is there's something about the way g mu nu interacts with matter fields the non-gravitational matter theory, which has something to do with the way rods and clocks behave. And that's really the issue I want to look at today. What is that relationship? Why does G mu nu get what might be called a chronometric significance? Why is it geometry? So to fix ideas, I'd say I want to say something about a recent development in physics, which I think for this audience I needn't say a great deal about because it's probably very familiar, which is Bekenstein's Tevez theory, tensor vector scalar theory, which is designed, it's a covariant reformulation of Milgram's Mond program, which is an attempt to account for rotation curves in spiral galaxies without the appeal to dark matter. And it aims to be consistent with the solar system tests of general relativity, the gravitational lensing, and it's supposed to provide a cosmological model. And it's a bimetric theory. That's to say, at least in its first formulation, the theory involved two metric fields, two second-rank tensor fields. If you have a theory that has two metrics, at most one of them can have chronometric significance. That's to say, at most one of them can be read by rods and clocks. Which one? And why one and not the other? So the pure in this theory, the pure gravitational field, what the field that Bekenstein incongruously calls the geometric field, has no chronometric significance. It's not read by rods and clocks. So I just want to go very quickly through the guts of this theory. Apologies to those who are very familiar with it already. Of course, something has to give. It's not just ordinary general relativity, because if you're not going to have dark matter, you have to have some way of accounting for the discrepancies of these rotation curves in spiral galaxies. So you introduce a vector field and two scalar fields, as well as the ordinary matter fields. You start with a metric field, which actually, the pure gravitational degrees of freedom have an action, which is essentially that of general relativity, is the Einstein rule, or the Hilbert action, better put. This should be familiar from general relativity, where R, of course, is defined, the Ricci scale is defined in terms of G mu. But because you have this extra structure, and particularly you have this vector field, you have a time-like vector field, and a scalar field, you can stretch and squeeze the original metric, giving you a new metric, the G tilde metric, sometimes called a physical metric. And of course, this is not a formal relationship. This is a significantly different metric. And then the total action for the system is, of course, it's the sum of the gravitational action we just saw, the Hilbert action, plus an action having to do with the scalar field, an action having to do with the vector field, and an action having to do with the matter fields. And then we get all the equations of motion of the theory by varying with respect, using Hamilton's principle, by varying with respect to G mu nu. That'll give us the equivalent, the counterpart of Einstein's field equations, and then with these other fields as well. But notice that the matter action associated with the standard matter fields is going to be associated with some Lagrangian density, as usual. Now, I'm going to write down, just generically, these fields are going to be represented by F of alpha. But notice that this Lagrangian density, we're going to write it down as depending on not G mu nu, but G tilde. And the covariant derivatives of our matter fields, which will appear in the Lagrangian, will be at least first order. They are now defined not with respect to covariant derivatives defined with respect to G mu nu, but with respect to G tilde. Or better put, the connection is naturally adapted to G tilde. So the covariant derivatives are denoted by this line here instead of a semicolon, and they're defined relative to the connection compatible with G tilde. Now, this theory has a strong equivalence principle, which is defined with respect to G tilde and not G. What is the strong equivalence principle? in a nutshell, it says that the non-gravitational interactions look special relativistic in the local inertial frames defined with respect to G tilde, not G. The non-gravitational interactions take their special relativistic form in the local inertial frames defined by G tilde, not G. What does that mean?
Normally you also include gravitational self-energy in strong equivalence principle. So you mean something else.
I know that there are different versions of the strong equivalence principle, but I don't want to.
I think you mean the weak one, but you don't mean the strong one.
Yeah, that's right. There's a weak, strong one.
But I think the strong is more than what you're saying.
So there are three of them. So just to make sure that what you actually mean. So the intermediate one is what I mean.
That's right. Now, when you vary with respect to G mu nu, you get an analog of Einstein's field equations. This is the usual capital G tensor, the Einstein tensor that you see in general relativity. This is the stress energy tensor defined in terms of the variational derivative of the Lagrangian of the matter with respect not to G but G tilde. But if now instead of this being the equation, you get other terms, in fact, you get a lot of other terms. It's pretty messy. But you do get, and this isn't something that's obvious from Bekenstein's papers, but it is in fact derivable, the little bit of hard work that Bekenstein actually did. It turns out that the covariant divergence of the stress energy tensor for the matter fields, again defined with respect to G tilde, not G, is zero. And that immediately is going to tell you that freely falling bodies, test particles that are built out of ordinary matter, will move along geodesics, not of G, but G tilde. So material bodies follow geodesics of G tilde. Light rays propagate on the null geodesics of G tilde. Material rods and clocks survey G tilde. Gravitational waves, actually, I'm not sure that that's correct, propagate along the null geodesics of G.
Probably not.
That's probably not.
Well, there is a big problem there. I think in this theory, the big thing is you can actually write the Ricci of the Einstein metric as the Ricci of the matter metric, plus a lot of germ with the back of it. So this is a unique thing about this theory. Not by metric theories, it wouldn't do that. So then you have an ambiguity about what is the graviton. What do you mean by gravitational waves? You mean the excitations of G tilde?
Right. Right.
And in the Bekenstein original paper, the speed of gravity was not the speed of light.
Right, okay.
Which is contradictory with what you said.
I accept that last time. But can I just, the point that I really want to make here is that if you look at these characteristics that we normally associate with G mu nu in general relativity, these operational characteristics, now they're being assigned to G tilde. And so far as matter interacts with the couples with G, would you call the gravitational field, the G in the Bekenstein theory, geometrical?
Well, I suppose you could make a clock with gravity.
Yeah. Yeah, but not with ordinary matter. Okay.
This field, the vector field, has to produce some kind of a Lorentz force in some frame, because the contribution of the action is like the maximum contribution. F mu squared minus 4. So if you work out the equations of motion, the vector field has to interact with the matter. So therefore, I don't understand what you mean by bodies falling freely. The Cronus principle says that the body falls freely if it is not affected by external forces.
Right.
And the U mu and the phi are said external forces. If you don't have them, you don't have the theory. Another point is that all the solutions of Bekenstein's theory violate local Lorentz invariants, frame-dependent solutions.
That's not true.
No, that's true.
Yes, it is.
No, it's not.
Could we come back to these detailed issues later in the discussion? I mean, in relation to I mean, it's certainly the case, at least Bekenstein claims. He claims he's done the derivation. I wrote to him because I couldn't see where it was in his papers, that this in fact holds, and he assured me he did the calculation. It doesn't obviously follow from this equation. Of course, the left-hand side of this equation has a covariant divergence. It's identically zero with respect to G mu. But what we want is a covariant divergence with respect to G tilde. And Bekenstein says he did the hard work and proved this is the case. Now, what that means is that freely falling bodies, even in the presence of a U field, are going to follow geodesics with respect to G tilde, not with respect to G. Well, in fact, the point of this really isn't really so importantly tied with Bekenstein, because first of all, Pedro Ferreira and colleagues in Oxford, and I think maybe Constantinos had something to do with this, showed that actually you can rewrite Bekenstein's theory as a single metric theory. This wasn't so obvious from the beginning, but actually you can rewrite it as a single, because of course you can always transform the G back into G tilde. Everywhere there's a G, you can write down a function involved G tilde. And it turns out that actually it's not so complicated as you might expect.
The problem there is that then you end up with a graviton, which is longitudinal polarization, and a few other things. And then you have this other issue, what is the graviton in this theory? You do have this geometrical, simple thing that you can end up with the Ricci of the old metric, the Ricci of the new one, and so on. But this is not the end of the story. No. You actually end up with a very complicated propagation equation.
Okay.
The trick is essentially to eliminate the scalar out of the vector,
right?
And then re-express the old metric in seconds in terms of the new point.
The point that I'm trying to make here is that is really that the Bekenstein theory is one of a number of bimetric theories. Drummond, Nathan Rosen, various other people have worked on bimetric theories, and what this makes us ask is the following. When we look in ordinary GR, let's suppose ordinary GR maybe with dark matter, or something, just ordinary GR, we ask ourselves, what are the operational aspects of the metric field? Well, we think of the geodesic motion of test bodies. We think of light rays tracing on L geodesics. And rods and clocks survey the field. They're connected with the metric. And so it has chronometric significance. Now, where does this come from in general relativity? In other words, why does G have the properties that it has that G doesn't have, say, in the Bekenstein theory?
What exactly does rods and clocks survey the field?
I mean that you can use a clock, for example, to work at the proper time of a curve, a time-like curve, and that proper time is given by the metric.
It's still just two metrics, or two types of matter.
Yeah.
Forget about parameters.
Yeah.
And you'd say those two metrics that mean have significance.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting question. That's a very interesting question. I mean, yes, if those rods and clocks are somehow used on a sort of in a practical way. I mean, what does geometry mean after all? When do we say something is geometrical? We know what we mean when we say this is geometrical in GR because it has these properties. Now, I'm not saying that it's obviously the case, perhaps, that G in the Bekenstein theory, the original, the gravitational G, doesn't, but it's not so obvious that it does either. Yeah,
wait. I maybe it's the same question that Shao asked, but then I didn't understand the answer. It's very easy just to write a different bimetric theory where there are two different metrics, and one of them determines the geodesic motion of massive bodies, and the other one determines the non-geodesics that light rays trace, and they're different.
Okay.
I'm sort of looking for the so what. I mean, it's possible to write lots of different complicated gravitational theories in which lots of things are not true that
right.
are true of general relativity.
Right, right.
Are you using this because you're trying to find a succinct statement of what is unique about general relativity?
I'm trying to use these bimetric theories as a way of focusing on an issue in general relativity. And that issue is, why do we say that G mu nu is part of space-time? Why do we say it's a geometrical field? Why don't we just treat it as a second-rank dynamical tensor field?
But why don't you say there's two geometries in bimetric theory? parametrically superposed.
Or five geometries, or you know. I mean, maybe for you, Harvey, the word geometrical has a meaning that it doesn't have for us. I mean, so do you have a meaning for geometrical besides there is a body of mathematics called pseudo-Riemannian geometry, and general relativity is written in that language?
Yes.
Okay, so maybe.
I think the point is that there are two ways of modifying Einstein's gravity. One is to stay within, somehow within the geometry of the scheme. For example, wild gravity or any higher order powers of the curvature. The other one is to take the pseudo-Riemannian geometry and you add extra degrees of freedom in terms of fields. Now this, most biometric gravity theories are of the latter kind. You have to add extra fields, which are not part of the topic. And this is what this is about. So in that sense, you still contain the pseudo-Riemannian geometry. It's just you have extra fields, like adding Maxwell's electronic field to Einstein's theory, to get Einstein Maxwell.
Right.
You still retain the Riemannian geometry underneath.
So maybe, because I'm thinking that maybe.
Yeah, I think the punchline will be clear as I go through. I should really say I'm not really that concerned with what we mean by gravity or by geometry, although I think that's a very interesting philosophical issue. But I really want to get back to the question of what the Bell was raising. In general relativity, we have, I mean, this is one version of the strong equivalence principle, and it's really saying it's not the strongest version. And Winslow Colin Wheeler simply put it, in any and every local Lorentz frame, anywhere and any time in the universe, all the non-gravitational laws of physics must take on their familiar special relativistic forms. Ohanian puts it, at each point of space-time, it is possible to find a coordinate transformation such that the gravitational field variables can be eliminated from the field equations of matter. Now, either way you put it, this is not something that follows from the field equations themselves. It's something you have to put in on top of the field equations. And it contains really essentially two components. One is universality. All the non-gravitational interactions pick up the same family of privileged local frames. So there's only one affine connection, which is a necessary condition for a geometrical theory like Einstein's. And second, minimal coupling. So that if we're asking ourselves, for example, how do we generalize Maxwell's equations from special relativity into the case of a curved space-time? Out of a flat Minkowski spacetime. And then it's basically, let me put it very simply, it's the common Gustafson-Coulomb rule. The curvature tensor does not appear in the generalized Maxwell's equations. And there are lots of counterexamples. There are theories that are counterexamples to these claims. And that doesn't violate the form of the Einstein's field equations, or perhaps the spirit of general relativity. In fact, Anderson himself says, look, if you don't have universality, if all the non-gravitational interactions fail to pick up the same local inertial structure, you're not going to have anything like a geometrical picture of gravity. But the question as to whether minimal coupling is absolutely essential to general relativity is far less clear. If you have a systematic violation of minimal coupling, you're going to have situations where it's conceivable the rods and clocks will not do what you normally expect them to do.
Is the case with the minimal coupling for the Kleinmorton field actually doesn't give you the strong equivalence principle. Because if you look at the Green's function locally, it doesn't reduce to the Green's function special relativity. In fact, you have a unique term, which is the conformal term to the Kleinmorton equation. So you cannot use minimal coupling as a universal solution
right. To
get the strong equivalence principle.
Right. I mean, the point that I'm trying to raise here is simply that in general relativity, if we want to understand what the connection is between rods and clocks, and G. Mu Nu, we appeal to something like the strong equivalence principle, which transcends the field equations.
I don't understand that. No, I mean, principles don't follow from the equation of motion of the theory. The equation of motion of the theory follows from a principle. For example, in GR, you start out with an action principle, the Soricci scale. Now, very first paper in Einstein paper, Einstein lays out why is that Lagrangian chosen. He's chosen because that's a unique scale in harmonic geometry, which vanishes in the absence of gravity. So I'm not even going to general covariance. That's what Einstein goes into, but that's controversial. But that scalar is the only scalar which vanishes in classical space. And from that, the thinking you turn the logic upside down.
Well, I'm going to say something like the following. Let's ask ourselves what we mean by the field equations. And I'm saying that they take a form that's it's sort of similar to Newton's second law of motion, F is equal to ma. What does that equation mean? It means whatever interaction there is in the world, you can find a force expression which will give rise, which will be associated with the acceleration of a body that's being acted on by that force. But you don't have to specify that. When you state the second law of motion, you don't specify what F is. In the same way with the field equations, Einstein's field equation, you don't specify what T mu nu is when you write down the general form of the field equations. In fact, generally speaking, the Lagrangians aren't specified when you write down Einstein's field equations. I'm just saying it's the form of those equations that doesn't determine T mu nu. Similarly, given that that's the case, It's not a consequence of the form of the field equations that matter, that the matter fields, if you can construct rods and clocks out of the matter fields, that they're going to survey G mu nu in the usual way. That's the claim that I'm making. Now, why am I making this claim? Because it's going to tie in with Bell's approach to special relativity. So I'd like to go ahead, if I may, to special relativity, and I'll come back to the case of general relativity. Let me just remind you of the situation at the end of the 19th century to understand exactly what it was that Einstein was doing in 1905. People, of course, were trying to find the effects of the ether wind. The electromagnetic phenomena were regarded as disturbances in some kind of background ether. We should be able to see the ether in the same way we can feel the presence of some sort of medium in which sound takes place. We can feel the wind if we're moving with respect to it. Why can't we feel the wind associated with the ether? And people tried to measure, first of all, first order effects, that's to say effects that depend on V over C, and they couldn't. They couldn't find them. And there was a relatively straightforward explanation for this, relatively straightforward. And that was the Fresnel drag coefficient. All of these experiments involved laboratories that contain transparent bodies. And in order to predict what these laboratories are, what's going to happen in these optical experiments, because the laboratory is moving with respect to the ether, you need to know what the refractive index is of a moving transparent body. And Fresnel gave an ad hoc conjecture about the refractive indices of moving bodies, and it solved, that was precisely what was needed in order to show that if it was correct, you wouldn't get first order ether wind effects. And Lorentz, in a very important work in 1892, provided something by way of a dynamical explanation of the Fresnel drag coefficient in his theory of the electron. So the lack of any experimental evidence of the ether wind involving experiments with first order was more or less understood. What was not understood, of course, was the second order effect. And in the first instance of the famous Nicholson-Morley experiment of 1887. This really shook people. There was no clear understanding as to why the second order effects of the ether wind didn't appear in the Nicholson-Morley experiment. Now, as you know, shortly after the experiment, Fitzgerald and Lorentz independently hit on the idea of spatial deformation of moving rigid bodies. And I just wanted to say two things about this hypothesis. First of all, it was not length contraction. It was not the Einstein length contraction. It was something more general. It involved a family of deformations of rigid bodies in which the ratio of the longitudinal change in length to the transverse change in length is just the famous gamma factor. And that's enough. It could even be a contraction in both cases. As long as the ratio of the change in length and dimensions of the longitudinal and the transverse is gamma, 1 minus b squared over c squared to the minus 1 half, as long as that's the case, then you can explain the Nicholson-Morley experiment. And neither Fitzgerald nor Lorentz could convince themselves that it had to be length contraction, at least not initially. And Lorentz's papers are full of the mentions of the other possibilities, including expansions. Lorentz himself came to the conclusion by the end of the century that it had to be a length contraction, a longitudinal length contraction, which is one of his family deformations, but he had no good argument. And Larmor also adopted pure Lorentz longitudinal contraction, but again, he had no good argument for it. In fact, if you look at the Michelson-Morley experiment, what does the Michelson-Morley experiment establish? It does not establish the invariance of the one-way of the speed of light. It establishes the fact that the two-way speed of light is isotropic, even in frames moving with respect to the ether. And if nowadays, if we do a sort of a modern kinematical analysis of the coordinate transformations that are consistent with Michelson-Morley, these are what they look like. They're the Lorentz transformations. I'm now assuming the Einstein convention for synchronizing clocks, which is really, you better put the Poincaré-Einstein convention, because Poincaré had it before Einstein, which affects that term there. It's the relativity spontaneity term, where we have a scale factor that's still undetermined in the Lorentz transformations, which is going to affect both the longitudinal and the transverse changes in dimensions as a result of moving which is body. But we also have a ratio of C over C prime, where C is the two-way velocity of light in the ether frame, and C prime is the possibly different two-way velocity of light in the moving laboratory frame. Now, just for your amusement, I thought I'd mention a special case of Michelson-Morley kinematics in 1 plus 1 dimensions. And this is associated with work of Boguslavsky and Budden. And here, if you choose, just for the sake of argument, let's put C is equal to C prime, so we have invariance of the speed of light. So this term here becomes unity. And we choose a value of the scale factor given by this term here, C plus V over C minus V to the power N, where N is any real number. Then it turns out that because the velocity transformation rule that follows from the Lorentz from these transformations doesn't depend on the scale factor because it just cancels, the speed of light is going to be invariant. We knew that anyway because we put C is equal to C prime. But also, it turns out for this particular value of K, these transformations form a group, which means they're consistent with the relativity principle. So we have some kinematics that are different from the Lorentz transformations in 1 plus 1 dimensions, which are consistent with the relativity principle and consistent with the light postulate. So why, how come we don't study them in relativity textbooks? They're consistent with Einstein's postulates. And the reason is, let's go back to the role of this K in kinematics. Here it is sitting in these coordinate transformations, and they're going to determine, amongst other things, the change in dimensions for moving bodies. And notice that this is not an even function of V. And what that means is that when a body is put into motion in that direction, so the plus X direction, and it's put into motion with the same speed in the opposite direction, the change in its dimensions will be different, because this is not an even function of V. So, of course, we need the isotropy of space. We need to assume that space is isotropic.
But that that's not consistent with the relativity principle, which says that everybody has the right to consider themselves as at rest equivalently, because that requires a transformation that's even for the reason you just said.
No, but that's for the relativity principle. Requires that they form a group.
Now, the relativity principle is what, I mean, it's a standard textbook derivation that the relativity principle requires that if you and I are moving relative to each other, then you see me contract, I also see you contract. And that requires an even function of the overseer. It's a standard argument.
The relativity principle says that when I put objects into motion, and I look at the behavior of the motion of these objects, if you do exactly the same thing, if you repeat the experiment in your frame, you're going to see exactly the same effects. Okay? Now, it may well be that in my original frame, the length contraction effect was anisotropic. But the relativity principle simply says, well, you're going to see the same anisotropic effect in your frame.
Well, let me get this right. According to this, this is the plus direction.
Yeah.
Okay. You and I are moving relative to each other.
Yeah.
Okay. Your velocity relative to me is positive, and my velocity relative to you is negative. So we would predict, I would say, observers who are moving with respect to me are transversely contracted, and you would say observers who are moving with respect to me are transversely expanded, and that would be an asymmetry, and that's inconsistent with the relativity principle.
I'm not sure I buy that.
Okay.
I mean, these transformations form a group. I mean, maybe we could argue this later.
Okay, question.
I mean, if the relativity principle is the full, I mean, if you're insisting on something like the full Lorentz group, that includes specialized objects. Well, that's not your argument.
No.
Oh, no, okay. Maybe we can come back to this. But anyway, my claim is that the reason that we don't have these transformations, of course, is because we're appealing to specialized objects. And that's a constraint on these on the length contraction.
I just want to raise a point that these are called dilatation transformations. Okay. So Maxwell's equations are conforming.
They are.
Whereas Einstein's equations are not.
That's right.
It's a trace of the T in the invariance of Einstein. So that has to, is dilatation invariance based upon the whole.
Yeah.
So Maxwell's photon has zero mass.
Yeah.
It's a trace of T in the zero.
I mean, Maxwell's equations are covariant under these transformations, where C is equal to C prime.
Whereas GR is.
Yeah. Well, now I just want to say something very quickly about what Einstein did. I mean, I've been talking about how you might try to get something like the Lorentz transformations by thinking dynamically or something. Fitzgerald, by the way, I should mention, Fitzgerald and Lorentz, when they came up with their shape deformation hypothesis, did not just introduce it ad hoc. This is very important. Neither introduced it as an ad hoc hypothesis. Why? Take the case of Fitzgerald, which is more straightforward. Fitzgerald was aware of a result of Heaviside. Heaviside did a little exercise in Maxwell theory. Heaviside asked the following question. If you take a charge body that has spherical symmetry, and you ask yourself, what is the electrostatic field given by Maxwell's equations for this stationary charge? Well, of course, it's a field that has spherical symmetry. So the surface of equipotential is a sphere. Now the question arises, what happens if you put it into motion? Now, of course, Fitzgerald was thinking, or Heaviside, they were thinking motion with respect to what? Well, with respect to the ether. But let's just ask the question, motion with respect to the frame in which Maxwell's equations are valid. Let's not talk about the ether for a moment. Just take a frame. Maxwell's equations are valid, supposedly, with respect to that inertial frame. What happens to a charge, it's moving, with respect to that frame, when you've just got Maxwell's equations in front of you? Well, if you solve Maxwell's equations, it turns out the surface of equipotential becomes an ellipsoid. Now, Fitzgerald read this paper and thought to himself, what happens if the forces between the constituent parts of a rigid body likewise suffer a spatial deformation as a result of motion? Now, nobody at the time knew that these forces were electrostatic. But Fitzgerald said, look, if this is happening in the electrostatic case, surely it's not far-fetched, is the word he used, to imagine that it's going to hold for the forces between the constituent parts of a rigid body. And this is precisely what led him to this idea of shape deformation as being a solution to the Michelson-Morley experiment. Now, this is a dynamical argument, and Einstein is now going to eschew the dynamical arguments because he felt he did not understand them well enough. So Einstein now jumps to a distinction that he introduced much later, of course, and that he spelled out in 1919. But he said, look, in 1905, Einstein had already discovered the existence of the light quantum, or proposed the existence of the light quantum, which is telling you that Maxwell's equations can't be universally valid. We don't know what the forces are anyway between the constituent parts of rigid bodies. We can't appeal to Maxwell's equations in a fundamental way. We can't appeal to the covariance group of Maxwell's equations. How are we going to proceed to understand what rods and clocks do when they're in motion? Well, when you don't know the dynamical story, you fall back, you do a strategic retreat, and you use something like a thermodynamical argument. You say, well, let's use a theory like thermodynamics, which is just based on phenomenological principles that constrain the dynamics of systems. So, for example, when you ask what is the efficiency of a heat engine, what are the laws of the efficiency of heat engines, in thermodynamics you get this straight away from by claiming that certain kinds of perpetual motion machines are impossible. It's a consequence of these claims about perpetual motion machines that you will get out some very non-trivial statements about the efficiency of heat engines. So Einstein said to himself, how can I find analogs to thermodynamics, thermodynamic principles, that will constrain whatever dynamics is responsible for the cohesion of rigid bodies in such a way that I can predict what they'll do in motion? So thermodynamics was Einstein's template, and he says this over and over again in his writings, not just in 1919. This is a principle theory because it's based on phenomenological principles, like thermodynamic principles. On the other hand, you have things like constructive theories. And a constructive theory for Einstein is something like the kinetic theory of gases or statistical mechanics. So it's based on hypotheses governing micro entities and their fundamental laws, and in general, it's much messier. Even if you knew what the laws were, it's just much messier. However, says Einstein, it seems to me, he writes in 1908, so this is well before he introduced the principle constructive theory distinction explicitly, that a physical theory can be satisfactory only when it builds up its structures from elementary foundations, and it's clear from the context of this paper that elementary means constructive. And then he repeats this point in 1919, when we say we have succeeded in understanding a group of natural processes, we invariably mean that a constructive theory has been found which covers the processes in question. Special relativity is not a constructive theory. It's a principle theory. Why does he fall back on something that's weaker? Because he doesn't have the resources. In 1905, he did not have the resources to build a constructive theory of rods and clocks.
Just a query?
Yeah.
Are these Einstein's characterizations precisely? Because there is some differences of opinion about what the definition, what Einstein meant by the distinction between principle and structure.
I mean, I think on my computer I've got the full text. Maybe we can come back. But I think I have read those very carefully.
Yes, I think Lee, in your book, you got it upside down. This is correct.
Anyway.
No, that's why I'm asking.
I mean, there are many places where he refers to the role of thermodynamics in relation to the special theory of relativity. And they're all of the same kind. And they're all saying.
But special relativity is always a principle
theory. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. It's a principle theory. Now, what is the weakness? What are the strengths and the weaknesses of a principle theory? What is the strength of special relativity? What's the strength of thermodynamics? Have you ever seen anyone construct a perpetual motion machine? And you never will. It's a good bet. It's a very good bet.
So the confusion, maybe it's just mine, in which case I apologize, is that there's an implication that principle theories constrain other theories because they have universal validity, because anything which moves must have, in a world with special relativity, must satisfy the principle of special relativity.
Exactly.
And any thermodynamic system in the world governed by thermodynamics must satisfy the laws of thermodynamics.
Exactly.
So that's a different consequence and shading of the distinction, whereas a constructive theory can apply to some phenomena in nature but do not need to be universal.
No. I mean, it's not so much the universality, simply that suppose we come back to thermodynamics and we say, how do you explain that entropy increases? for isolated systems. How do you explain that? Well, the standard, insofar as there is an explanation, it goes something like this in thermodynamics. Well, you look at, say, the laws of thermodynamics, one of which says that you cannot construct perpetual motion machines of the second kind. Okay? It seems to me that we should be asking ourselves, why not? Why can't you construct a perpetual motion machine of the second kind? Well, thermodynamics simply says there's no answer to that in the theory. It starts from the assumption that there are no perpetual motion machines of the second kind. Now, the weakness of the principle theory, I've said that this is very well founded empirically. Nobody has built a perpetual motion machine of the second kind, and probably nobody ever will. But the weakness of the theory is it's not really explanatory. Because statistical mechanics holds out the promise. The details are horrible, and nobody even agrees on them in general. But it holds out the promise that you can explain why there are no perpetual motion machines in the second.
Isn't Newtonian dynamics a principle theory or a perspective?
It's a principle theory.
Right.
It's a constructive theory. It's a constructive theory.
Right.
Statistical mechanics, I mean, the analogy is best understood in relation to thermodynamics and statistical mechanics. That's the analogy that Einstein always has in mind, or the kinetic theory of gases. Thermodynamics versus the kinetic theory of gases.
No, but the laws...
The laws of motion meanings.
As Newton specified, his theory, it's a principle theory.
Every theory has principles.
So I think the distinction between principle and constructive theories is very...
It's not a categorical distinction. It is a very natural distinction. It precisely captures the difference between thermodynamics and the kinetic theory of gases.
Yeah.
The type of explanation in both theories is very different. And so this is precisely what Einstein was picking up. He wanted a theory that looked, that whose explanatory, its method, as it were, the explanatory method, was just like the method in thermodynamics. And why does he fall back on this? He knows that it's weaker. He knows it has less explanatory content. Because the resources to do a constructive theory were not at hand. Well, I've already mentioned that what Einstein's views are, that ultimately a good explanation involves a constructive account. Now, let me just say something very quick. I don't need to explain this diagram to this audience. Here's Professor Kaluza with his stay-at-home clock. Here's Professor Klein that goes on a trip. Of course, the proper time that's determined by these ideal clocks, it's going to be different. We're going to get a clock retardation effect here. The two clocks were in phase here, they're not in phase there. And of course, what makes Minkowski geometry funny in relation to Euclidean geometry is that the kinky line is actually shorter than the straight line. You're all aware of the twin paradox. I'm putting this picture here, by the way. This is a device that you can find in the Museum of History of Science in Oxford. You can find several examples of this device. This was used by people in the late 18th century to measure the distances of roads between towns. How do you measure the distance of a road? How do you measure the distance between a town? You strap this device to the back of a carriage, a bus in those days, pulled by horses, and you simply record the number of revolutions, and the number of revolutions gets recorded on a dial. And this was called a Wegweiser, from original German term. Now, the maker of this Wegweiser had a premonition of special relativity. Because what does that thing look like? It's like a clock. And in special relativity, a clock is a Wegweiser of space-time. That's exactly what it is. It's a Wegweiser of space-time. Now, what does it mean to say it measures the distance along these curves? Well, the distance is given by the Minkowski metric. So we can give a nice geometrical account of what a clock is doing. Of course, you can also predict this effect just by using Einstein's Lorentz transformations, which contain, in this equation here, time dilation. That's all you need. Predict the clock retardation, you can use time dilation. But it's very elegant to think about it geometrically. So now the question, the philosophical, but seems to me, question arises, did Einstein explain time dilation? Well, in some sense, yes, because it's a consequence of his 1905 principles. You take the relativity principle, the light postulate, and the isotropy of space, you get Lorentz transformations. The Lorentz transformations, insofar as they encode physics, tell us about length contraction and time dilation. That's all you need. But it's a principal theory approach. It's like thermodynamics. Is it the whole story? Well, you might say no. It's not the whole story. It's part of the story. But really, the whole story is took place when Minkowski came along and geometrized special relativity, because now you understand what a clock is. It's a way wiser of the space-time geometry that was established by Minkowski. And this is probably in the philosophical literature, the way people most people think about it now. Minkowski, the geometrical structure of space-time, is the constructive account of special relativity. But wait a minute. Haven't you just said in geometrical terms what Einstein was already saying with the Lorentz transformations? I mean, haven't you just translated one approach into a geometrical language? What have you explained? And by the way, how does the clock know what space-time it's in? How does it know it's not in Galilean space-time and it's not supposed to dilate? Maybe the ultimate deep constructive accounts of time dilation, which is really what Einstein was after, was neither this, and you remember when Einstein's original reaction to Minkowski was this, was really just kind of a mathematical superfluous. He put learned superfluous. Incidentally, Einstein came back to change his mind about Minkowski, but not because of the Minkowski geometry per se, but because Minkowski had done to special relativity what Heaviside had done to Maxwell's equations. He made it covariant. Okay. Well, maybe the correct way of understanding time dilation, and now I'm getting closer to the end, is that you have to really appeal to what a clock is or what a rod is. You have to appeal to the internal constitution of these bodies, and ultimately you have to say that the stability, the cohesion of matter has to do with quantum mechanics, it couldn't be otherwise, and the fundamental laws of the non-gravitational interactions, which are quantum mechanical laws, must be Lorentz covariant. And so you're back to something like a more constructive account, a slightly more constructive account of special relativistic reasoning. Now, there's a lot that could be said here. There's an awful lot that could be said. But I just want to say there is a tradition in the literature, maybe not that well known, which includes Bell's paper, but it's by no means the only one. Weyl made remarks along these lines. Wolfgang Pauli in his wonderful Encyclopedia Einstein Special Relativity at one stage said, isn't it interesting to compare Lorentz with Einstein? Here is Lorentz talking about these forces involved in the cohesion of matter, and Einstein is able to get the Lorentz contraction without ever appealing to anything about the nature of forces. He says, does that mean that we have to understand Lorentz contraction independently about the atomic theory? And Pauli says, no. You do not understand Lorentz contraction outside of the context of atomic theory. Length contraction is a very complicated process. It would not happen were it not for the fact that all the fundamental forces inside these rigid bodies are Lorentz covariant. Eddington said similar things. A man called Swan.
Since this is your key point,
yeah.
Haven't you just said that the fundamental microscopic theory must appeal to Lorentz covariance and therefore appeals back to the principal theory, which is special relativity? That is, the fundamental quantum atomic theory could be Galilean invariant,
yeah.
Special relativity, multiple special relativity, double special relativity, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, and at the bottom, there is a principal theory that says, by its structure, what kind of dynamical interacting theories of matter are possible.
Yeah.
And it is therefore that principal theory that is the final ultimate explanation,
yeah.
And not some
constructive theory. I completely understand your point. This is so important. I want to answer this in length. Could I come back to the first question? I just want to finish up the... Okay, but I will come back to your question. It's very important. In another paper that Bell wrote in 1992, just before he died, actually, this is not true. This was published after he died. But this was a talk that he gave in Belfast about Fitzgerald. If you are, for example, quite convinced of the second law of thermodynamics, of the increase of entropy, there are many things that you can get directly from the second law, which are very difficult to get directly from a detailed study of the kinetic theory of gases. So, for example, if you have a little heat engine, a steam engine or something using gas, steam, to work out the laws of the efficiency of the heat engine are very easy in thermodynamics and very hard in kinetic theory of gases. But you have no excuse for not looking at the kinetic theory of gases to see how the increase of entropy actually comes about. I mean, nobody in their right minds would stop with that. In the same way, although Einstein's theory of special relativity would lead you to expect a Lorentz contraction, you're not excused from seeing how the detailed dynamics of the system also leads to the Fitzgerald contraction. And what's remarkable about this is that Bell doesn't seem to have been aware of precisely the way Einstein used this analogy of the principal constructive theory, particularly in relation to thermodynamics and statistical mechanics. So there is a tradition in the literature of people who have adopted a dynamical approach, or dynamical approach, to length contraction. Let me come back now to general relativity, and very quickly close the circle. So this is the last slide. This is something that Clifford Will wrote in 2001 in one of his monumental papers on the empirical basis of general relativity. The property that all non-gravitational fields should couple in the same manner to a single gravitational field, G mean U, is sometimes called universal coupling. Because of it, one can discuss the metric as the property of space-time itself rather than as a field over space-time. I mean, really the question that I was raising before was, what is G mean U? Well, it is a dynamical field. I mean, there's an action for G mean U. There are field equations. It's a second order tensor field. It has some strange properties. It doesn't disappear anywhere. But it's a field. It's a tensor field in space-time. What makes us call it space-time itself? I mean, how often have you read that in general relativity, for example, the metric is the part of the container of space? It is, in a sense, the structure of space-time itself. Why did we say that? Why don't we say the same thing of the electromagnetic field? And the answer is because of this universal coupling. This is because its properties may be measured and studied using a variety of different experimental devices composed of different non-gravitational fields and particles. And because of universal coupling, the results will be independent of the device. Whenever you hear the word geometry, you must always think of universal. That's what makes something geometrical. It doesn't matter what device you use to measure the geometrical properties of the structure. Thus, for instance, the proper time between two events is characteristic of space-time and of the location of the events, not of the clocks used to measure. Okay. So far, so good. But the point that I want to stress here is that the reason that we have universal coupling and the reason that G mu nu has this property of being apparently a property of part of the structure of space-time itself is because of the strong equivalence principle. It's because matter couples to G mu nu in a very special way that is not determined by the form of the field equations. Okay. What this means is that special relativity should be understood not as some limiting case where G mu nu becomes Minkowski everywhere. That's a bit like saying that the classical limit of quantum mechanics should be the case where H bar goes to zero. Well, unfortunately, H bar is not zero. And unfortunately or fortunately, we do not live in a world in which G mean U is E to mean U everywhere. But we do live in a world where, if we choose a point in space-time, we can find local coordinate systems which make the metric diagonal, first derivatives of the metric vanish. That means the connection coefficients vanish at that point. Such that if we're doing experiments in which we can ignore tidal effects, and that depends on the experimentation, but the stuff we have in the laboratory, then the form of the equations for the non-gravitational interactions looks special relativistic. And that means our rods and our clocks are going to do what they're supposed to do. They're going to behave nicely, special relativistically. And this is precisely Bell's point. It's a dynamical understanding of rods and clocks, because of their internal constitution, and because they're built out of matter fields those matter fields are subject to a constraint in general relativity called the strong equivalence principle. So it seems to me that to understand why the GMU has the properties that it does, and we sometimes refer to it as being the structure of space-time, is because of a contingent fact or a contingent property of general relativity that's not itself, strictly speaking, the constants of the laws of the Einstein field equations. I'll stop there, but I haven't forgotten Lee's question.
So, questions? Maybe you want to answer these.
Yeah. Lee, when I'm saying, when I appeal to the Lorentz covariance of the fundamental forces or the laws that govern the non-gravitational interactions, I'm not saying that it's a fully constructed theory. It is obviously not, because I'm not specifying what the laws are. But now, I'm going to give you an analogy. Suppose you were doing thermodynamics, and you put down as one of your principles that there exists a state parameter called entropy. I'm just going to make that a law of thermodynamics. Okay? Now, when you're familiar with ordinary, you know, classical thermodynamics, you're aware of the fact that historically it came out of a program where you were appealing to phenomenological principles, like the non-existence of perpetual motion machines. The claim that there exists a state parameter, that's to say a function on the on the phase space of thermal systems, that's called entropy, doesn't seem like a phenomenological principle, does it? I mean, it seems as you've stepped out of this program where everything is based on these phenomenological principles, and you've introduced something a bit more abstract. In other words, you've moved away from a pure principle theory into something that's in between a principle theory and a constructive theory. That's exactly what Einstein, that's exactly what Bell is saying. Bell gives an example in his paper of a moving circular atom, a two-dimensional atom, which is just a heavy positive charge and an electron circulating around it. He solves Maxwell's equations, and he shows that this thing undergoes a distortion effect. This is a purely dynamical argument. That's part of the pedagogical thing of what Bell was doing. But of course Bell knew right from the beginning that this was hopeless, because this is not a stable model of matter. You've got to end up putting in quantum mechanics. And in his paper, Bell says it when he says, look, if you do this thing properly, you've got to put in quantum mechanics. It all becomes very messy. But it is enough to know that the fundamental quantum mechanical account is Lorentz covariance. That's not a fully constructed theory, but it's not really a principle theory either, because you're appealing to something that's much more structured about the world. It's a symmetry. It's not just a phenomenological principle. It's not like a relativity principle. It's not like a light postulate. And there is a very strange thing, if you read Einstein's autobiographical notes, just to finish, there is a very strange twist in the notes. Because although he talks a lot about, in the autobiographical notes, he talks about thermodynamics being his template. And you know, historically, what did he do? He said, I'm looking for principles that are like the laws of thermodynamics. And of course he falls on the relativity principle in the light postulate. By the way, the light postulate is not the invariance of the speed of light. It's the claim that the speed of light with respect to a given frame is independent of the speed of the source. It's very important, because it's independent of the relativity principle. Yet in his autobiographical notes, when he looks back on this process, he says, what was the universal principle that played the role of thermodynamics? It's the Lorentz covariance of the laws. And that does not do justice to his own approach. Because his original approach was a principle theory based on phenomenological principles. And that's not Lorentz covariance. It's the relativity principle in the light postulate. Lorentz covariance is a consequence. So that's what I'm... Do you see the point?
Yeah, so I think there is a confusion here in Einstein's meaning between the 1920 stuff and the autobiographical notes. And the confusion is whether, to my reading, which is very unscholarly, so I could be wrong, is whether the emphasis is on principles as phenomenological versus... in the later writing you just quoted, principles is universal. So let me make the philosophical assertion that I wanted to make, and then one can sort out what Einstein meant.
Yeah.
Okay. The assertion is that to state there are universal principles and there are theories of particular phenomena. and that in physics, theories of particular phenomena are couched in frameworks defined by universal principles, and that what happens, say, in the explanation of thermodynamics by statistical mechanics is that a claim for a universal set of principles is later replaced, that is, the laws of thermodynamics as in the 19th century is, and the irony, of course, is that Einstein was working on statistical mechanics.
It
was replaced through statistical mechanics by reference to another, a different set of universal principles, which is Newtonian mechanics plus reasoning statistically.
Right.
And that is how progress, how a big step in physics is measured.
Arwin, I've been listening to you talk about this for many, many years. Or so. I think finally I've understood something. So let me tell you what I've understood, and you can tell me whether it's right or not. I think you're arguing for a background-dependent theory of space. Let me say why I think that. Because your argument started out with biometric theory. Biometric theory is a background-dependent theory. There is a dynamical metric which depends on the matter distribution. There is something or other, scalar, tensor, metric, whatever you like, which is a background. And you are arguing that...
Bekenstein would deny that. He says all of his fields are dynamical.
That's a scalar field.
So
there's no background. Well, this is
I know.
If you use the other theory, you need the vector field is not dynamical.
How can this be? Because it does what the strongest equivalent. You see, so I'm not quite convinced that is true.
But look, Joy, let's put aside the Bekenstein theory for a moment.
Yeah.
I mean. There's a standard criticism of the Bell argument. I don't know whether this is what you have in mind, which is that it is dishonest because it's basically silently appealing to a preferred frame.
You see, this is not my criticism. This is Bell's own criticism.
Not.
Bell says at one point that then you will have a preferred frame that you will never see. That's an eccentric way to make the world.
No, but he's saying you can understand the Lorentzian pedagogy without believing the Lorentzian philosophy. This is the key point of his paper. What he's saying is the following. And I mean, if you look, for example, look carefully at Lorentz's papers and Fitzgerald's papers. Look carefully at Larmor's papers. Look carefully at Poincaré's papers. They all talk about the ether, but they never use it. What are their arguments based on? Their dynamical arguments based on the laws of Maxwell's equation. They start with a frame in which Maxwell's equations are valid. Okay? Now, of course, for an ether theorist, that's the ether rest frame. But now let's just play the Einstein trick of kicking away the ether. It's like Wittgenstein's kicking away Wittgenstein's ladder. You just start with a frame with respect to which Maxwell's equations are valid. All the consequences of the covariance properties of Maxwell's equations are played out. You ask what's happening to a rod. It's built electromagnetically when it's moving, with respect to that frame. I'm not talking about coordinate transformations now. And what Fitzgerald and Lorentz basically established was that something funny is going to happen to the spatial dimensions of that rod. Or at least there's a plausibility argument based on the analogy with Maxwell's equations, okay? It's got nothing to do with the ether. It's wholly to do with the structure of these equations. Now, what Bell points out, which is beautiful, and what a number of other people have pointed out as well, is that if you start with this approach, and you assume, for example, that everything is Lorentz covariance, which is a property of the laws in that frame, I mean, it's just a mathematical property of those laws in that frame, then when you move, when you co-move with these moving bodies, and you establish a new rest frame defined by these moving bodies, you can find a natural coordinate system relative to which Maxwell's equations, lo and behold, they take the same form again. And the coordinate transformations are precisely the Lorentz transformation. In other words, you derive the relativity principle. You derive it. So you're doing the analogous thing that you would do in statistical mechanics if you could show why there are no perpetual motion machines of the second kind. In other words, what's so beautiful about this approach is that the relativity principle now becomes a theorem rather than a postulate. And so once you've got the relativity principle, why on earth would you appeal to some privileged frame? Well, just by being perverse. You can always be perverse if you want to. But it's not part of the structure of the Bell argument. Because the relativity principle is derived.
So there is no prior geometry.
No.
I mean, well, I'm missing the link between biometric theory and what you're arguing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sorry. Maybe the biometric theory was a bit of a red herring. What I was trying to say in the case by introducing the biometric theory was, this is a theory that has two metric fields. Now, think of Will's argument at the end of the talk, where he says, here we are. He says, because of this notion of universal coupling, because of it, one can discuss the metric as a property of space-time itself, rather than a field over space-time. If that's right, then I would say that there's doubt in a biometric theory as to whether one of the metrics can be, how does he put it, a property of space-time. Because after all, the universal coupling of the matter fields is only going to work in relation to one of the metrics. You can't work for both. I'm just trying to stress that the meaning of the metric depends on how the matter fields couple to it. And this is something that's brought out very well in the case of the Bekenstein theory, or any biometric theory for that matter.
Okay, so actually there's a Q, so let's do this balance.
I want to ask a question about something different. It seems to me that one thing you have not discussed is the meaning of what you call explanatory or explanation. And to me, the unhappiness of Einstein, if there was one, was connected directly to the fact that the notion of explanation that Einstein was using, having in his mind, was the notion of explanation as seen by the 19th century physics. And to me, you're trying to argue with the same notion of explanation in mind, whereas the 20th century physics, and Einstein was probably the first to actually introduce it with his special relativity, saw a variety of what one can count as having explanatory power, and a variety of effective physical theories. You know, this is basically the analogy would be a biologist may refer to chemistry as having explanatory power for biology, but will probably not refer to fundamental quantum physics as having a lot of explanatory power for biology all the way up. So there is an autonomy of levels of explanation. And what happens to me with this approach of principle theories that has been repeated and can be repeated is that this allows one to explain aspects of theories that can otherwise not be explained. For example, you know, why special relativity and not doubly special relativity or something else, because we have this principle, and if we modify it, we get another theory. So this sheds light on the structure of the theory, et cetera, et cetera, and all this has explanatory power, which the 19th century notion of explanation did not count for. So something that is missing to me in this analysis is the evolution of what one takes for an explanation.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. I mean, it certainly was, I mean, Einstein himself is certainly clear on this matter. He didn't like the way the explanatory account works in special relativity in his original paper. He didn't like it. He referred in his autobiographical notes to the sin of treating rods and clocks as primitive bodies. He said they're not primitive bodies, they're moving atomic configurations. And he said, look, I've got one part of my paper that's pure kinematics, in which I derive the Lorentz transformations. The other part of the 1905 paper is all about Maxwell's equations and their covariance properties. But what is it? And so the first part of the paper contains these things called rods and clocks. What are they? They're built out of the stuff that's in the second part of the paper, the dynamical part of the paper. The idea that there's a fundamental categorical distinction between kinematics and dynamics is just wrong. Now, for Einstein, it was clear that he was appealing to the template of thermodynamics. Now, this is not a new 20th century way of thinking. This is 19th century thermodynamics. Nothing new about it. Of course, what really was new in a sense was that very rarely in the history of physics had symmetry principles being used as postulates. There are counterexamples. Huygens used the principle of relativity as a postulate. Newton, before the Principia, used the relativity principle as a postulate. But in the Principia, he thought he could derive it in corollary 5. So there was something new in Einstein's thinking, which was using symmetry principles as starting points. But the actual method of explanation in 1905 was just plain old the same method that he used in thermodynamics. I don't see anything new in it. In fact, I see precisely why Einstein was unhappy about it.
Okay, so
good
notes.
That's okay. But this bill has.
Okay, well, this is the case of George's.
Yeah, I just want to make two points. Getting back to Frankenstein's tennis, his theory is that you have to distinguish between the biometric part and the vector group of the UU. And he puts the UU in the way he does for logical reasons. He wants to get rid of dark matter. He says his gravity theory is an alternative to dark matter. So you put in the UU field in order to get more bending of light into which you got, and not to get lazy light. However, the way he did it, he has UU squared equal to plus or minus 1 depending on the metric signature. This is built into the action principle through a Lagrangian principle. So this means you have an ether, kind of ether theory, which has also been published by James Phillips in the math.
Yes.
So you have an ether theory, in a sense, back to Lorentz. There are phenomenological reasons for doing this. So,
why back to Lorentz?
Well, because Lorentz believed in the ether theory. Okay? It is an absolute space that's built in. You have a preferred frame for the solution.
Well, no, but it's a cosmological frame, and we don't think this is a violation of Lorentz and Bering.
No, just read the page by Jacobson and Martin. You're violating local Lorentz and Bering.
No, I know one paper by Jacobson and Natalie, in which they specifically introduce a vector field in order to break local Lorentz.
That's right.
That's not what what Beckenstein is.
Well, yeah. It's the same action. The vector part is the same, exactly. The other point I wanted to make is that the biometric theories, you can construct, I've published a biometric theory. And then with a vector field, not focus. And then this vector field did not satisfy dramatically Jacobson's structure. It satisfied what's called Maxwell's copper equations. Mm-hmm. So it's fully relativistic. Okay. And the matter metric, which you refer to, is in fact a real metric, whereas the other one isn't. You can prove this.
What do you mean by saying it's not a real metric?
Well, there are two metrics.
Yeah.
Chain unit plus the gradient of the scalar of field times the other metric. And the matter metric, which is used to raise and lower the indices in the engineering process, is a metric, whereas the other one is not. So in the matter frame, matter metric, particles do move along to the distance. And the I actually proved this equation you had that T mu squiggle bar mu is zero. It's a long proof, but you can actually prove it.
Right.
So, but that's not, the Einstein theory is a ether theory. In fact, Starkman and collaborators have recently turned it into just a vector theory plus metric theory. It's an ether theory.
Yeah. Well, they say ether, but what they mean is. Exactly. I mean, Ferreira also has a theory. I mean, it looks as if the Beckenstein theory is now in a sense redundant, because there's theories that replace the role of dark matter that only involve the vector field. They call that the ether, but as Joan was saying, it's not something that introduces
global. That's why the storm influences.
Can I? Sorry.
We have a vector field, just a major thing you don't need to do. Maxwell's theory is a vector theory. It's not a vector theory.
Can I just say something in relation to Lee's? I didn't really answer Lee's, the last remark that he made. Come back to Einstein again. I'm going to say what my reading of Einstein is. Einstein became embarrassed as he got older by the role that the light postulate played in special relativity. Because Einstein thought that ultimately the guts of special relativity was the universality of the Lorentz curve. So whatever the laws are, whatever the non-gravitational interactions, special relativity is saying they are Lorentz curve, period. That's its role. It's what he called the restricting principle. Okay. It's really got nothing to do with light, because electromagnetism is just one of several matter theories, if I can use that term. Really nothing to do with light. So he was kind of embarrassed that light played such an important role in his 1905 postulates. But when he retold his story, his autobiographical notes, about using thermodynamics, he forgot his own plot. Because he wanted to say the guts of special relativity is the Lorentz covariance of the laws, which is right. But that's not really what comes out of thinking about it thermodynamically. What comes out of thinking thermodynamically are his 1905 postulates. But of course, that puts emphasis back on the light issue, the special nature of light, which he doesn't like by that stage. So I think in a way, I don't know whether he did this consciously or not, but it's not altogether surprising to me that he failed to capture the full nature of his 1905 reasoning in 1949.
Okay, so that's a kind of colleague.